Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The person who's appointed as Comptroller General of the United States is supposed to keep a nonpartisan eye on the nation's financial health. So when David Walker stood in front of the National Press Club a couple of days ago saying that America's projected budget deficits are not sustainable without significant changes, people sat up. They took notice.
It's time to admit that we're in a fiscal hole and to stop digging. The federal government must start exercising more fiscal discipline on both the spending side and the tax side. The simple fact of the matter is, while many spending increases and tax cuts may be popular, they may not all be prudent. The time has come for a fiscal Hippocratic oath. Do no harm.
It is a message that is remarkably similar to that of the economic columnist for the New York Times. Paul Krugman has been warning readers for the past 2-3 years to be sharp, critical, even suspicious anytime the Bush administration uses numbers to back up its economic agenda. It's a warning that he lays out in some detail in his new book, The Great Unraveling. Connection listeners, are you worried about the deficit? Do you think it will affect your life or the lives of your children? And how confident are you that the policymakers in Washington have your interests at heart when they talk about getting the economy back on its feet? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, Paul Krugman is a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University. He has written and edited dozens of books and papers, mainly in his area of expertise on international trade and finance. He's been writing his column in the New York Times for the past 3 years, and he's here with me in the studio. Nice to see you in the flesh finally, Paul.
An actual face to go with the voice.
Now, we're talking about the deficit today, and just to make sure we have the numbers right, I want to hear just a little bit more from the Comptroller David Walker once again.
The Congressional Budget Office, CBO, estimates that unified budget deficits in fiscal years 2003 and 2004 will be $401 billion and $480 billion, respectively. These numbers are up significantly from fiscal 2002. Furthermore, CBO estimates that excluding the Social Security surpluses, the total deficit for fiscal years 2003 and 2004 will be $562 billion and $644 billion, respectively. Now, if all these numbers are making your head spin, and if you're having trouble keeping up, don't worry. Just remember, they're all big, and they're all bad.
Big numbers, bad numbers. But still, Paul, somewhat abstract. Hard to take figures that size and apply them to me, to you, to you know, ordinary people. What should we be paying attention to if we're just a taxpayer here?
You should be thinking about what it means for the programs that you count on. The key word in what Walker said is unsustainable, and there's a principle in economics that we often invoke that says if something is unsustainable, it will stop. At some point, even the federal government has to pay its bills, and it's not collecting remotely enough revenue to pay the bills now. One way to look at it, that's so, if you take Social Security out, which is something you really should do because there's liabilities when the baby boomers retire, the federal government is borrowing about a third of its total spending. So it's roughly one-third of the programs that it provides are not funded by the revenue base. And that means that at a certain point, at some point, if we continue along this course, the people who supply that third of the budget, the lenders, will say, gee, we don't think the U.S. government is a very good risk, and the flow of money will dry up, and then something drastic happens. So we're heading off a cliff, and every honest projection shows us heading off a cliff. And what does it mean? Sharp cuts in Social Security and Medicare, maybe even a financial crisis for the U.S. government. Hard to predict exactly how things fall apart, but they will fall apart on this current trajectory.
You're talking, though, when you talk about those kind of implications of a growing deficit, of fairly long-term trends, what's going to happen in the future. Does it mean that this year, next year, 5 years from now, in my own pocketbook, I'm not going to necessarily feel the effects of a growing budget deficit?
I think not this year or next year. 5 years from now is actually, I think, pretty serious possibility. Here's the point. If the bond market, okay? I hate to sound so economist here, but the bond market was completely naive. If it just kept on lending money without any worries until the money ran out, then we might go 20 years before we hit the wall. But things don't work that way. The people who are lending money try to look ahead. And I think that by 5 years from now, maybe six, at worst 7 years from now, people, if we're still in the hole we're now in, if we still have this fundamental mismatch between what the federal government takes in and what it, and the promises it's made, then lenders are going to say, we don't see how this is going to work. The baby boomers are going to retire in a couple of years. This is really unsustainable. This may be the greatest nation in the world, but politically it's also a banana republic. And so I think that we actually hit the wall. We have a crisis of lender confidence, which forces everything else. Not that far away.
The value of the currency goes down. Our interest rates go up.
Interest rates go up, and the federal government simply cannot raise money. This is what we have. Whenever I make this parallel, people say, but it can't happen here. But Argentina, there came a point in early 2001 when the Argentine government simply could not borrow. No one would lend it money because the interest rate that you'd have to be paid to compensate for the risk was so high that, in fact, if it borrowed at those rates, that would guarantee bankruptcy. So it just imploded, a kind of financial black hole. And that's what, if you take current tax rates and current spending promises and roll them forward, it says that we're going to do in Argentina.
But I know there's people listening to us right now who are saying, Argentina is not the United States of America. The U.S. is a country so financially powerful that other countries will kill to just peg their currencies to the U.S. dollar.
That's right. We look and we say, but this is the United States. And I guess the right response is it still? I mean, yes, the resources are there, right? The U.S. has the lowest overall tax burden of any major, as a share of the economy of any major advanced country. We collect taxes total, federal, state, and local, around 26% of the gross domestic product, which is way low. And Canada, it's 38%. So if you ask the question, could the U.S., can we pull up our socks and do all of this? Yes, we can. No problem. Except it has to happen politically. And then you say, well, what's the possibility that we're going to – well, let me put it this way. There are three feasible scenarios. One of them is that we have a – substantial tax increase, roll back all of the Bush tax and then some. The other is that
Can we just say not going to happen?
All right, that's not going to happen, right? The second is that we have major cuts in the basic middle class entitlements programs, Social Security and Medicare, because that's where the money is. You can't have serious budget cuts without attacking that. Of course, that's not going to happen. The AARP will stage a mass march on Washington. And then you say, well, but the third possibility is that the U.S. government goes bankrupt. You say, well, that's not going to happen. And yet some one of those three or some combination of them has to happen because otherwise that's the only way it adds up. So it's inconceivable and yet inevitable that something awesome and very unpleasant is now locked into our future.
And I can't but help thinking that people listening to us now will also be concluding, yeah, okay, Paul, but that's not going to happen. No politically elected president or administration is going to knowingly, willingly lead a country from its position of economic strength into some kind of black hole where the value of the currency drops. And that people will say it doesn't really matter who's in the White House. They're just not going to let that happen.
Well, this is where you go from hard and fast budget arithmetic, which tells you that what we're doing now is not sustainable, to a little bit of political speculation and attempt to understand what's going on in the U.S. Now, my conclusion, what I talk about a lot in the new book, is that you really have to understand that we do not have an ordinary government. We don't even have an ordinary conservative government in the United States. The people now in charge, certainly the people in Congress and many people with strong influence in the administration, have a very radical agenda. They really hate the welfare state, if you want to call it that, the social safety net, whatever. They hate the basic programs that we've built up, the Great Society and even the New Deal. They have long sought to scale those things back. They know that a frontal assault doesn't work. If you say to the public, let's sharply cut Social Security benefits, let's reduce Medicare coverage, that's not going to happen. But they often say, well, we can starve the beast. We can deprive the government of its lifeblood. And you'll hear Grover Norquist, the most powerful lobbyist in Washington, very much part of the Republican leadership structure, says, I don't want to eliminate the government. I just want to shrink it down to a size where I can drown it in the bathtub. Now, the way they do that is by depriving the system of revenue, by cutting taxes to the point where those programs cannot be sustained without a major tax increase, without rolling back their tax cuts, which they intend to make politically impossible. And that's – you have to think of this as a planned crisis. It's how do you take on the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt? How do you demolish the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt? Well, you do it by not making sure that there isn't enough revenue to maintain those institutions.
But couldn't you also say that if you follow this argument logically along – and say, and we'll talk more in the program later on about tax cuts and the way that tax cuts benefit really a fairly small percentage of the wealthy people in the country, that the Grover Norquist constituency that you're talking about, once it marches off to the ballot box, gets squashed. Because if it is just really the wealthy elite in the country who are benefiting by this notion of getting rid of all the pillars of the Great Society and the New Deal, then the voters will simply say, we're not having it.
But these people are masters of deception, masters of deceit. I think that was the old J. Edgar Hoover book. The way it's always sold is it's continually shifting rationales, right? If you ask about the tax cuts of the last few years, they were, we had a surplus. We had to give it away. Oh, no, the surplus is gone, but we needed to stimulate the economy. But, not that. We need to. It's about long-term growth. They constantly shifting rationales, but they always put a front on it that makes it seem something benign, something populist even.
Well, let me ask you about one, for example. When the last tax cut was laid out in the newspaper, there was that line that said, and I don't quite remember the figures, I'm sure you've got them in your head, the average family of four is going to see an average benefit of $1,000 and some odd from this. And you know, everybody looked at that and went, that can't be bad.
Wow. Yeah, this last, the way that they do this, it's partly just false salesmanship, but it's also the construction. There's famous phrase from the Reagan administration. Reagan's budget director once admitted that middle class tax cuts were a Trojan horse that would enable them to smuggle in what they really wanted, which was tax cuts for the rich. What the Bush strategy has been, I think, very brilliantly organized, actually, there's always some middle class scraps thrown in which are a significant benefit to selected middle-class families. So if you were that first Bush tax cut, if you had two children under the age of 17 and had an income of $40,000, you would get fairly big child tax credits. And so they said, the typical family of four earning $40,000 gets a tax break of $1,600 a year, which sounds pretty good. But of course, most families, even if they have two children, the children are grown, or they haven't had the children yet. Or if you made $30,000, it turned out that because the child tax credit wasn't refundable, you weren't paying enough income tax to actually get the child tax credits. So in fact, a very small number of people really got that, and the typical middle class family ended up getting more like $400.
Connection listeners, when you hear those words from Washington, do you think of yourself as being sold a bill of goods? Is this part of a strategy to lead the Republican radical agenda, or is Paul taking this just a little bit too far? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Support.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Paul Krugman is with me in the studio. He's a professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, also a columnist for the New York Times. And you can find a lot of his writing and in the New York Times and other material gathered together in a new book called The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. And it's bracketed by Paul's sense that there's something rather sinister going on in Washington right now that people aren't paying attention to. And part of writing the book and sitting with me here in the radio studio is his hope to draw people's attention to that. And let's take it another step further if we can. Because everybody likes the idea of tax cuts,
right?
Less taxes. Who would argue with that, right? Are you saying that people have been fed that line now for so long that they've lost a sense of responsibility about their about what they have to pay for, that taxes go to fund the government, that people are almost pathological in their pursuit of tax cuts?
Actually, the public is not that excited about tax cuts. Polls consistently show that if you ask people how high a priority is a tax cut for you, they aren't all that thrilled. And if you pose it as which would you prefer, tax cuts or setting money aside to secure the future of Social Security, it's overwhelmingly Social Security. But what they have been, you know, most people don't sit down with Office of Management and Budget and Congressional Budget Office projections and read them. If they're told that we can afford it all, they're likely to believe that we can afford it all, that we can have tax cuts and it's not going to cut services. There's a tremendous amount of propaganda that is fed to people. And, you know, again, people can be fed. People in their daily lives are not looking at things closely. So a truly unscrupulous propaganda campaign can convince people of things that are flatly untrue. One of my favorite examples is the estate tax, which even in its current incarnation, it's going to phase out completely now thanks to the Bush tax cuts. But in its current incarnation, there's a very high minimum. Less than 2% of people are going to pay any estate tax.
This was the tax that over which people were losing the family farm and
That's
small
right.
businesses. And this was the tax that, you know, was going to prevent all that from happening.
Yeah, they tell you all about that, but they never actually mention any family farms or small businesses lost because of it, because that almost never happens. And turns out that about half the public is of the belief that most people pay estate taxes. And that's just because of a relentless propaganda campaign. To give you a much sadder...
Who pays those taxes then? What percentage of the public?
Well, less than 2% pay any taxes, and it turns out that more than half the tax is paid by about 3,000 estates each year. 3,000 very, very large estates.
I was going to say, these are very wealthy
people. This is very, very wealthy. The estate tax repeal is one of those things that conveys the bulk of its benefits to true plutocrats. But look, the most shocking, ought to be revelatory example of how this whole thing works was this referendum in Alabama, where the governor, who is himself a very conservative Republican, but he said, we need more revenue. The state is deep in the hole, and I want to raise more revenue. But while I'm at it, I'm actually going to make Alabama's tax system a little fairer. It's a system that actually taxes the poor and working families very heavily and taxes the rich very little. So he said, what I'm actually going to do is have a program of reducing taxes on the poor and the working class and raising them a bit on upper classes, which will net provide some additional revenue, which we're going to spend all of it on education. He held a referendum, was necessary to pass it, and the tax cutters went an all-out publicity blitz. They hired people with rural black accents to say this is going to raise your taxes, which it wasn't. It was actually going to lower the taxes of the target audience. And the referendum failed by a 2-to-1 vote. And this is how, you know, money influenced propaganda is a big thing. People can be fooled.
But are they really being fooled? Or is it that people, when given the option to say yes or no to a tax increase, invariably will say no? I mean, look at what happened in Seattle earlier this week when people who are drinking the, you know, high test espresso are asked to, you know, approve a 10-cent tax on that. The latte tax, they called it. And people voted on it, and they said no. It comes back to what I was saying earlier. I mean, I don't think if you ask people, anybody wants to pay taxes.
Right. I look at the bill from Princeton Township, and I'm not happy. But the thing that has happened is that people have lost, in many cases, have lost the sense that there's a connection. If you ask people, do they want to cut in services? They say no, of course not. You ask them, well, do you want an increase in taxes? And they say, no, of course not. But the political system is no longer getting people to understand that there is a connection between the two. And it's also, and this is, I think, very important, there's a very active propagandizing to convince people that there is no connection. And also that tax increases means tax increases on you, when it, in large part, it actually means tax increases on people a lot richer than you.
But it would seem to me that the great failure we're talking about here isn't in whatever the success of the propaganda is from the right, but the failure of the left to put out its own message. You're saying that there's really only one person whistling a tune and everybody is paying attention to...
Well, this in a way gets back to one of the themes in my book and one of the themes in the column. Yeah, the left, what we, the left, formerly known as the center, people who actually think that the government needs to pay its way and that, that Social Security is a good thing and all of that. But anyway, the opposition to the tax cut mania has been ineffectual, but it's also had a very hard time getting the message out. And that has a lot to do with the state of the media. One of the, as you'll notice reading the book, which gives you some sequence, I got somewhat radicalized during the course of the 2000 campaign and afterwards. And part of it was watching the way that the Bush team would, well, the word is lie, technically, say things that were manifestly not true. And it just would never be reported. You would just never have stories in the press that said they're saying that 2 minus 1 equals 4. That you would have, you know, I once said if Bush said that the Earth was flat, then of course Fox News would say the Earth is flat, and anyone who says otherwise is a traitor.
We actually have somebody on the line who wants to take issue with you. So let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina.
Sure.
Now, and Stephen's joining us. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, how are you this morning? Appreciate the time this morning. Listen, there's a conspiracy theorist in every constituency, and to me, that's what the problem is. I think that what this guy's putting out is propaganda, just like he's talking about the propaganda from the Republicans. I'm an independent voter. I didn't ask for a tax cut. I don't want one. I think that's a simplistic way to ask for votes from simplistic people. But on the other hand, the Democrats are, they're simplistic as well, because it's all about giveaway programs to get people in their constituency and satisfy, you know, there seems to be a segment of the population that wants handouts. And we're talking about handouts and tax cuts for one group of people versus handouts and giveaways and welfare on the other side.
So, Stephen, who's telling you the truth these days?
That's the problem. That's the problem. I don't really feel like anybody's telling me the truth. And, you know, as a voter, I'm going to go and vote. I'm going to try to make the choice, regardless of party. Like I said, I'm an independent voter. I'm going to go with the people I think I can best determine me the truth. But, boy, I tell you, it's really hard for me to trust anybody when all you get from both sides is, just vitriol. That's the way I feel about it. Anyway, I appreciate the time this morning. It's really informed. I appreciate it. But
just hang on with us, Stephen, because Paul's here, and
yeah.
I'd like to give him a minute here.
Let me be clear. I'm not being a conspiracy theorist. I'm not attributing hidden motives to people, because I'm just actually looking at what they say.
Well, no. You are attributing hidden motives. You're saying that they're promising a good life, but in truth, what they want to do is shrink and starve government for an agenda they're not talking about.
Well, who is they? I mean, Grover Norquist happens to be a helpful person to because he is the most powerful lobbyist in Washington, works close hand in hand with the Republican leadership in Congress, and he's upfront about it. He says, I want to shrink this government down. I want to starve it of its lifeblood. Now, of course, President Bush doesn't say that. The man in front doesn't say that. But if you read what the people who formulated the program say, they're pretty open about it. So if this is a conspiracy, it's a pretty out in the open conspiracy. What I can say about, you say, well, isn't everybody doing it? And the answer is, look, yes, of course, there's pork barrel. Everybody does that. There's irresponsibility. Everyone does that. But this is epic. We've gone from a $200 billion budget surplus to a $500 billion budget deficit with tax cuts being the biggest single factor in that swing. War. The one thing that you always do when you have a war is you have at least some tax increase, because war is expensive. Never before that I'm aware of in U.S. history has an administration pushed for tax cuts in the face of war. This is different. This is not your ordinary average dirty politics. All politics is a bit dirty, but this is much worse. I've never seen anything like this. So, I don't know if our caller is still on the line. Yeah, but
Stephen, are you still there?
I'm still here.
By all means, inform yourself. Go read the text of what David Walker, the Comptroller General, said. Go and find out what the go to the websites that do budget analysis and take a look at what's happening. I don't think my beef on this on media has been that the things that anyone who was willing to spend a few hours doing that kind of research knows, those ought to be distilled down. Those ought to be in your newspaper that says, well, according to all of the projections, this tax cut is not affordable. And that by and large did not happen.
And what Paul is saying beyond that, Stephen, is that journalists have become so lazy that they say, here's what Bush said, here's what Daschle said, and on to another story, that without that kind of sort of independent digging in on that. Do you think that that do you share Paul's point of view that you have a hard time getting what you want from the media here and understanding who to believe?
I agree that we're being treated by everybody in a real simplistic way. We're getting sound bites. We're getting, they're feeding us what they think we want, and a lot of people are sucking it up. I mean, the people on the tax cut side, I mean, they won't even, like you said earlier, they won't even invest a dime on a $3 cup of coffee, to help people. I would pay a dime. I think that's a good way to raise revenue. On the other side, the Charlie Rangels, the Hillary Clintons, they're appealing to the other side. Those people aren't looking for tax cuts, but you don't want to categorize people, but too many people are looking for handouts, and we're pandering on both sides. It's just about pandering. It's all about the lobbying effort. It's crazy. It's John McCain, who I supported in the last election, used the term corrupt, and of course he offended everybody by doing so in both parties. But that's exactly what it is. It's a corrupt system. Unfortunately, I can't suggest that I have a better one, but I tell you what, it'd be nice if we could begin to get the facts just up front.
Stephen, I want to thank you for your call. It was nice to have you on the program. 1-800-423-8255. And we're going next to Durham, North Carolina. Robert's joining us. Hi, Robert.
Yes, hello. Actually, I have a question, and it's always been kind of hard to find the answer to. And I know that the government makes its money, from different things like selling bonds and treasury notes and collecting taxes, which, as you kind of go into, there's lots of propaganda and ways to fool people with that. But one of my questions is, as far as the Federal Reserve, which is our central bank, I'm kind of interested in how much money they have to borrow from the bankers. And what I'd be curious of is who are the bankers that are making profits? Because it seems to me...
You mean when the deficit gets bigger and bigger, is there anybody raking, anybody making money?
Yeah, somebody's got to be giving you the money somewhere to spend, regardless of how much it is. If there's only so much real income coming in that, get from excise taxes and things like that, there's got to be a certain amount of money borrowed from somebody. So I'm guessing that money being borrowed is being borrowed from the member banks of the Federal Reserve, which then leads to, if those banks are like, Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase and Dillon Reed and Goldman Sachs and a lot of the other big banks, what's their interest in it, I'm curious, as far as what's their stake and how much money are you talking about?
Okay, Robert, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
Okay. Actually, the federal government mostly borrows its money by selling bonds and not, for the most part, to member banks of the Federal Reserve or anything like that. It's private investors. It's actually kind of interesting now, because if you ask who really is directly financing that debt, it's Japanese pension funds and not the Federal Reserve in the United States, but the Reserve Bank of China, which is buying up a lot of dollar securities, U.S. government securities. So it's a large part of it is foreign money now. I don't think anybody's making a killing on this, although the U.S. banks that often act as intermediaries are making a lot of fees off it, but I don't think that's – I'm not a conspiracy theorist on this one, okay? but it's a definite – no, if there's a message I'm giving, it's actually that the people lending money to the U.S. government are setting themselves up for a loss, because they're imagining that U.S. government debt is a sure thing, and I don't think it is at this point.
Well, you made one of your career marks by looking ahead and providing more wisdom than anyone else on the Asian currency crisis. When you look at the fact that it's overseas investors who are buying American bonds, are you saying that those are the investors who, should there be a shift in a bond rating, would be the first ones out?
The general rule is all big investors are pretty amoral. So even if it was Citigroup, that rather than the Reserve Bank of China, that was the swing investor, I wouldn't have very much faith in their patriotism keeping them from pulling their money wherever. But as it turns out, in fact, the moment when we really start to hit the wall is when the Reserve Bank of China says, gee, maybe we better diversify into euros. Those Americans, they have the resources, but they don't look too responsible politically.
1-800-423-8255. Next call from Hyannis, Massachusetts, and Bob's calling in. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question. The president says we can't afford, with the economy the way it is, to raise taxes at a or to make these spending cuts because, you know, it'll sort of take all the out of the oomph out of the recovery. And you know, I recently heard Howard Dean say that actually in 92, 93, 94, we raised taxes. We had a plan to balance this off going forward, and that caused a whole lot of investor confidence and money to go into the market, and that was largely responsible for the recovery. So, I don't know if that's true. I mean, is that true that we can sort of use budget balancing as a growth strategy? Because W is saying the opposite.
Okay, it's 92 is a disputed example, so I won't even. The truth is we're not sure about exactly what happened there. The general principle here is it's okay to run budget deficits. It's even a good thing to run them when the economy is depressed, as long as you have a credible plan to balance the budget as you climb out. And we don't. We have, if you look at these things, if you look forward there, forget what the administration says, all realistic projections say we're looking at $400 billion a year at least deficits as far as the eye can see, and then they go up when the baby boomers hit Social Security and Medicare. What is true is it's a good idea to run a deficit in the short run, but it matters what kind of deficit you have. So you want to run a deficit to support the economy when it's weak, but you want it to be a deficit that stimulates demand, that puts money in the pockets of people who are likely to spend it. We aren't doing that. There's been minimal aid to state and local governments. So there's been very little help to prevent school teachers from being laid off and cuts in public services. There's been minimal tax cuts for lower and middle income Americans, which are the people most likely to spend. And instead, there have been big tax cuts for people at the top of the income distribution who are less likely to create jobs with that money. We're running a budget deficit of about $500 billion a year, which is equivalent to the wages of 10 million average workers. I haven't noticed 10 million jobs created. Have you?
Paul Krugman, author of The Great Unraveling, is my guest this hour. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. So, who's telling the truth? Who do you believe? Where are you getting the goods? 1-800-423-TALK. Join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Paul Krugman, the New York Times will tell you, is on vacation. Paul Krugman will tell you he's pretty busy these days, running around talking about his new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. I found out that he was on vacation by looking at his bio on the website today, alongside a list of comments of readers who read Paul Krugman. And one person wrote in to say, "Perfect, Krugman. Points out lots of problems and offers not one solution." Right underneath that, "Go, Krugman, go. We the Krugmaniacs salute." Look, the truth is that anyone who says that the president's not telling the truth and his economic team are a bunch of liars is going to be controversial. So, Connection listeners, we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Marblehead, Massachusetts, and Galiel is calling in. Hi, Galiel.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Mr. Krugman, first, I just want to thank you for speaking up. I don't think it's hyperbole to say that you're really an American hero. It's not easy to stand up and sound like Chicken Little and get accused of conspiracy theories, and I salute you for doing it. What I want to ask you is about the non-economic implications of the pending economic implosion. You focus a lot on economics, which is your profession, and on the real radical agenda that the folks in power have right now. Others have written about the Pax Americana that the neoconservatives are trying to impose on the world, sweeping through the Middle East and transforming the world with a preemptive war.
Galiel, let me nudge you along. What's the question here?
Well, the question is, when you add all of that together, along with the radical religious agenda that we have right now of dismantling basic civil rights in this country, what happens when one of those apocalyptic economic scenarios occur? In the past, we had bad economic times. We threw the bums out. But now we have people who are dismantling the social safety net, controlling the propaganda and the media outlets, and really limiting our ability to fight back. What happens if we go through either a bankruptcy or we end up with another Great Depression? What happens to the democracy in our country?
The short answer is, of course, I don't know. The longer answer is, I don't know, but I'm pretty nervous. Again, it's one of the things I do try to get at it in the book, and I've written a fair number of columns that go beyond the economics narrowly. Let me put it this way. When I first started writing about these guys, I realized that there was something funny. You know, we're not dealing with your ordinary average politicians whose policies I disagree with. We were talking about a level of dishonesty that I hadn't seen before. You know, all politicians are a little bit dishonest, but not on this scale. And I tried to put aside my thoughts that might spill over to other things, that maybe we were really talking about some pretty scary people. I have to say, as the years go by, the sense that it's not just about economics keeps on growing. And, you know, I thought it was a terrible – I berated myself for thinking in the first few months of the Bush administration that these people might have an authoritarian streak. But it turns out they do. I was extremely berated for readers right after 9/11 for saying what I knew to be true, that they were already moving to exploit the atrocity politically. But, of course, they were. So it just keeps on getting worse. And – I think they would have they certainly do not want to lose an election, not for just because of the usual stuff, but because there's a lot of reason to believe that there are major scandals that are effectively being covered over through sheer political force right now. It could be very ugly if there's a regime change and there are some actual open investigations of Dick Cheney's energy policy or those Halliburton contracts in Iraq or the role of the coal industry in Wyoming. And there's a whole bunch of those things. Which means that, I think we do need to be vigilant. This could be really pretty bad, and it's certainly going to be very ugly. And I guess the question is how bad does it get? But these people make me very, very nervous.
You're an economist. You study graphs and things. I get the sense, because I read what you write fairly regularly, that if we were to graph the sort of political education of Paul Krugman over the last couple of years, we'd have watched the needle swing from the economic side of the graph to the political side of the graph. And that I listened to you describing that yourself, and I hear you feeling almost uncomfortable with that.
Well, there's a sense in which what I know,
that's all right. You're a smart guy. People know you're a smart guy.
Mothers don't let your sons grow up to be pundits, right? I never had the ambition to be a political pundit. I was somebody who was doing economics, and I wrote about that. And that led to the job at the New York Times because in 1999, when they hired me, the economy was the thing, and the public policy seemed relatively less interesting, and foreign policy certainly wasn't at the top of anyone's agenda. And then along comes, right here at home, a government which reminds me uncomfortably of the dysfunctional regimes that I've studied in other countries. You know, I was as an economist, I was a bit of an ambulance chaser. I was always interested in political and political economy crises abroad. And all of a sudden, I see this happening here, and I realize that I had to talk about the politics at home. And
so Malaysia, Singapore, Mexico, and then the United States?
Well, Indonesia, Argentina, and then the United States. To Malaysia, some of these other countries sort of have weathered the storm. Let me tell you, here's a story from my past. In the early 1980s, I was a staff economist at the Council of Economic Advisors. This was the Reagan administration. It was a non-political position. It was also very interesting. One of the things we did, we dealt with, I was in interagency meetings, and there were people from the National Security Council at these meetings. And the National Security Council economics people were mad as hatters. They were loons. They were completely crazy. And I and the other people there consoled ourselves with the thought, well, the real security people at NSC must not be this crazy. And then along came Iran-Contra and the cake in the shape of a key. And it turned out that what I saw was representative of the character. Now, when I look at economic policy of the Bush administration, I saw dishonesty, irresponsibility, something really scary. And that has led me to suspect that it's not just the economics. And in fact, we've seen, of course, a lot of evidence of that now. And so I have dabbled in things like questioning the case for the war in Iraq, even though that's not my specialty, because I got some judgment about what these people were like.
Yeah, $87 billion was sort of...
Well, that was part of the budget, a bait and switch. First, we land on the aircraft carrier, we pass the tax cut, then we say, oh, by the way, there's this $87 billion we didn't tell you about.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Holliston, Massachusetts now. Ren's calling in. Hi, Ren.
Good morning, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Krugman. I have a question, and that's, it seems to me that all of this tax stuff was long ago and far away from President Reagan. George's dad called it voodoo economics. How did we get here? Did I miss something? Was there a turn that suddenly this is no longer voodoo and it's going to actually work when it hasn't before?
Well, if you hear these guys talk, they'll say, well, the economic success of the economy in the late Clinton years was all because of Reagan's tax cut. Just, you know, 18 years later, somehow when we had a recovery in 1983, they didn't say that was because of what Lyndon Johnson did in 1965, but they will tell you that. But no, this is actually, but let me tell you, I actually miss Ronald Reagan. The policies were irresponsible, but they were based upon honest craziness. They had the voodoo economics. There was a theory. If you bought the theory, then their policies made sense. They didn't deny that they were cutting taxes on rich people. They said that cutting taxes on rich people will produce trickle-down and rising tide will raise all boats. They didn't cut taxes on rich people and say, no, this is really a tax for ordinary working Americans. So there was a kind of innocence. I never thought I'd say that, but there was a kind of innocence about the Reagan years that I miss. These people are much, much worse.
Ren, thanks a lot for calling. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Next call to Williston, Vermont, and Judy's calling in. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Dick. Hi, Paul. I was wondering, Paul, if you could just, do you see a candidate in this upcoming election that you think might be a good direction to go? I'm looking for something to do as an average person.
Right.
What you're describing is just so disgusting and incredible. I want to know, do you see anybody out there who might have a glimmer of a good direction to go? And
okay.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Actually, New York Times rules prevent me. The rule at the New York Times is you can imply, you can hint, you can slander. Well, you can't slander, but you can cast aspersions, but you can't actually endorse candidates. So in principle, I'm not even, you know, I can't even say that I think you should vote against Bush.
I think we've sort of inferred that from earlier in the program.
That's up to you. But what I think – and so I am certainly not going to get into handicapping the Democratic field. I think two things. One, my economic judgment, and one, my political judgment, which is no better than anybody else's. Economic judgment is that if a candidate isn't talking about a substantial rollback of the tax cuts of the last 3 years, he's not serious. Now, if he wants to say, oh, I want to preserve some part of it, but I'm open to other suggestions for revenue, okay. But if he's not talking about the substantial rollback, he's just not serious, because we just cannot. There is no way to square the circle without getting most of that revenue back and then some. In terms of not political judgment, just, you know, amateur like anybody else who reads the papers, I don't think a candidate who runs as being like George Bush, only less so, has a chance here. I think there's a lot of people, a large fraction of the American public is really, really upset and is angry, but it won't be motivated unless it has a candidate that seems to speak to that. I thought that the 2002 midterm elections were essentially the people who might have turned out for the Democrats didn't feel they were being represented. Now, that was foolish on their part, because, you know, votes still matter, but we need to tap into the sense of outrage.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. When I look at what you're saying to Judy, look for someone who talks about rolling back the tax cut. I mean, we know Karl Rove, rolling back the tax cut automatically becomes in favor of bigger taxes, in favor of bigger taxes at a time when nobody wants to pay those taxes. It's like, go jump off the bridge.
Well, again, this is why I don't want to be a political pundit, but it seems to me that someone...
But you are a political...
It seems to me that somebody can... that we ought to be able, at the very least, that last tax cut, the one that was passed after George Bush dressed up in a flight suit, landed on the aircraft carrier and said, it's your patriotic duty to cut taxes, and then after it was through said, oh, By the way, this Iraq thing isn't over and it's going to cost a lot of money. And even the $87 billion is based on the assumption we're going to get about $40 billion from our allies, whom we've treated so politely. You know, this, I think there ought to be a case to say, hey, wait, we were hornswoggled, at least on that one.
Let's talk, though, just a little bit about the worst-case scenario that you've described. If, in fact, there are influential, powerful people in government or advising government right now who have this notion of throttling what we call government down to the point of something with it you could drown in the bathtub, then in the long run, that would or could lead this country to some kind of economic collapse. I'm just taking in some of the other things that you're saying here. But then nobody wins. I mean, then even the neoconservatives, the people who have their winter villas and their summer places and their penthouses, I mean, even those people lose. And that seems to be a flaw in
But they imagine that it can be done, that instead, that faced with a severe budget problem, that the government can be convinced and the public can be convinced that we need to privatize and roll back and that we end up with a government. Both Karl Rove and certainly Grover Norquist, but Karl Rove have also often talked nostalgically about the McKinley era, that we can go back to being a country which is wealthy and democratic more or less, but has really no safety net, just a minimalist government. I actually think they're crazy. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that if you actually ask what happens in the fallout, it's much messier and may in fact boomerang on these people. But that's what they imagine. They see this as a route to getting back to the golden age before FDR.
Paul Krugman, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Paul Krugman's new book is called The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Connection listeners, you're welcome to continue the conversation in the forum section of our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our program's produced by Khalil Bird, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.